Jean-Philippe Marquis has crafted a dazzling and unsettling film essay on forestry practices in the Pacific Northwest, home to the world's tallest trees. Juxtaposing sublime aerial imagery with Velite workplace footage, he meets people whose livelihood is connected to the forest economy and culture, tempering a critique of neoliberal forestry practices with an up-close understanding for people who labor within the system. The opening weekend of Sylvicola will take place at the Cinémathèque Québécois and Cinéma Public, with screenings starting from Friday, March 22nd. For more information, go to cinemapolitica.org/film/Sylvicola. We hope to see you there.
Condemn Israel's Holocaust against the people of Gaza and their civilization, asserting not in our names. But the current military frenzy is part of a long violent process. From the Wings Archives, 1990, six Jewish women from Israel and the U.S. tell Susan Rivo what opened their eyes and made them say, not in our names.
It just reached a point where I couldn't stand my own silence anymore, and I felt like if I was feeling that, probably a lot of other Jewish people were feeling that too.
That's Miranda Bergman of the Break the Silence Mural Project, a group of four Jewish women artists who traveled to the Israeli-occupied West Bank to paint murals with Palestinian artists.
We formed the Break the Silence Mural Project because we wanted to do something to make a statement as American Jews in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for independence and as a voice for peace and reconciliation between Jewish people and Palestinian people. This was the first time that I think any of us did anything in our work as Jewish people, and it was a pretty profound experience and very important for us. Personally, I was raised to believe that one of the things to feel really good about being a Jew was that Jews were people that had a tradition of standing for freedom and against oppression, and that we were a people who had known both oppression and resistance. Passover was always my favorite holiday as a child because that was talking about, you know, slavery and liberation, and my parents, who were progressive people very much so, used that time as a time to instill pride in us as Jews for that reason, because of that tradition, the tradition of standing for justice. And we really felt that by doing this project and encouraging other Jews to sort of break out of their fear and their paralysis, that it's reclaiming the best of our traditions, and that in fact what's happening now in our name, I mean Shamir and those people, they come and they speak and they say we are doing this for all Jews, all American Jews and Jews all over the world, and that's a lie. In fact, what they're doing, I really feel, is a betrayal of our tradition, is a betrayal of the best of our tradition. So really we feel like we're claiming it, and far from being self-hating, we're in love with our traditions and feel wholer now than we ever have as Jewish people.
Bergman says that negative stereotyping of Palestinians has prevented Jews and other Americans from recognizing their distinct and vital culture. She says the media has conducted a sophisticated campaign to portray the Palestinian as terrorist.
It's like Palestinian terrorist, all one word. That is, thank goodness, starting to break down now. But until a year or two ago, the general attitude of U.S. citizens in general, and especially Jews, was that the Palestinians were crazy terrorists out to kill them. And that is really a distortion and a slander and a demonization of that people and their long struggle and their culture, which is very rich. We are cousins. I mean, we are Semitic peoples, and we are cousins. And you see similarities in music, in love of learning, in humor, in a certain kind of family thing. A lot of similarities, and then differences also. There's a lot of basis for alliance among Jewish people and Palestinian people. I'm really convinced of that.
In addition to painting murals, they taught art classes to children whose schools had been closed by the Israeli military. She describes the reaction the four Jewish women received upon arriving in the West Bank.
We encountered some surprise, some shock, a few people whose faces fell on the floor, and they picked them up real fast when they found out we were Jewish. We were always totally out as Jews. It was part of the reason to make the trip. But we found a lot of, even if there was initial shock, that the communication ran much deeper after that. People really did differentiate and welcomed us, embraced us, I mean, as family, really, truly as family, and had a lot of stories about how their mother had this best friend who was Jewish, and this recipe was from some Jewish woman they knew. And, you know, the younger kids, a lot of them had never known Jews except for in the context of a soldier shooting them or beating them. And we felt gladder that we were there because it helped to break that down.
Bergman also notes the important role women are playing in Palestinian society.
One of the most joyful things about the trip was our whole relationship with Palestinian women and the privilege we felt of being able to be so included in the life of the Palestinian women we were around. Just living the daily life and the daily lives of women in Palestine has really taken these amazing changes and leaps since the Intifada. It's like an explosion of new opportunities and liberation in a lot of ways, partially because so many thousands of men have been jailed, partially because it's this whole awakening and uprising that really pulls out of everyone their participation, or the great majority of people, including the women.
Marcia Friedman lived in Israel from 1967 to 1981. She helped found the first battered women's shelter, the first rape crisis center, and the first legal aid society for women. She was also a member of the Knesset and an early advocate of a two-state solution. Friedman explains how the women on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have made the first moves towards peace.
We very naturally establish bridges to the women on the other side, that is to the quote-unquote enemy. The sense of identification with the losses that Palestinian women were suffering, the sense of identification with their struggle, and I think from the Palestinian women's side to the Israeli women, the sense of what they were losing because of the occupation, of increasing violence within Israel, the increasing rise of the radical right, which is always bad for women. I think that these things were playing themselves out, and I think those are the reasons. The collaborative, cooperative relationships developed first among Palestinian and Israeli women, and then later in the larger peace movement. Certainly within the peace movement, women have taken the lead both among Palestinians and among the Israelis. And this has happened since the Intifada began, but I think it was imminent all along. The women have much less to lose. All women, always in these sorts of roles, have much less to lose. They do not have fancy university positions for the most part, or access to media. They don't have privilege within the society. And so they're not worried about losing their privilege if they're too radical or if they step over the line.
Friedman believes American Jews have an important role to play. There are a number of organizations in the United States that influence U.S. policy toward Israel. Though these organizations claim to represent the entire Jewish community in the U.S., the men who head them have never been elected by the Jewish public. With half of all American Jews unaffiliated with any Jewish organization or synagogue, it seems clear that organizations such as AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, a lobbying group that supports virtually all the policies of the Israeli government, represent only a small, though powerful, segment of the Jewish community.
My feeling right now is that the ball is in the court of the American Jewish community, and that the key to what's going to happen over the next several years in Israel, because I do believe this government will last, depends upon not only American foreign policy, but upon the reactions and responses of the American Jewish community. I've been involved with organizing Women in Black here in San Francisco, but I have now begun to give a lot of thought, and I'm going to be giving a lot of energy to the Jewish Peace Lobby, which is trying to organize as a countervailing power to AIPAC. I think there are a lot of things we can do. I think one of the main problems that progressive American Jews have is that we have always resisted being part of the organized Jewish community, the quote-unquote establishment of the Jewish community. And so therefore we've really left a vacuum, and you know, there's a voice out there that is speaking for all Jews because nobody else has a voice. So I think that one of the most important things right now is to begin to organize that other voice, the progressive voice within the community. And I think it's a very large one, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if it were in a majority.
Friedman believes there has been an oversimplification of the issue of Soviet immigration to Israel. Despite the recent announcement by the Israeli government that Soviet immigrants would not be settled in the West Bank, Friedman says that the housing crisis already existing in Israel will force native Israelis into the occupied territories, potentially displacing still more Palestinians.
If the amount of housing that is going to be built within the next 2 years is only equal to the number of Jews emigrating from the Soviet Union, and that housing will be built within the Green Line for the Soviet Jewry, it still means that there's going to be an awful shortage of housing for native-born Israelis who are going to find that they can only go to live on the West Bank because that's the only place they can find a place to live.
Recently, the United States agreed to a request from Israel that it drastically reduce quotas for Soviet Jewish immigration into the U.S.
I think that it is absolutely deplorable that the United States government has established quotas, and but the American Jewish community has said not a single word against it. The parallels to the 1930s are just so incredible, and here we are just doing nothing at all. If there was open immigration, open gates to Soviet Jewry into the United States, Soviet Jewry would not be a problem in terms of Middle East politics whatsoever, because clearly most of them would choose to come here.
Penny Rosenwasser is a longtime community activist and journalist. Like many Jewish feminists inspired by the example of women of color who had confronted racism in the women's movement and reclaimed their cultural identities, Rosenwasser began to identify strongly with her Jewishness.
We celebrated the holidays and that kind of thing, but I was not wild about being a Jew. I was not wild about being different. And I think as I got older, I got active on the left, but never saw issues around being Jewish as very important. In fact, they seemed very unimportant. So I would call myself on some level at that point a self-hating Jew. And then in the mid-70s, late 70s, this book, Nice Jewish Girls, came out, and I really identified. I loved that. I learned a lot from it. And I got very into being Jewish and very proud of it, and in fact became an ardent Zionist, because I really understood for the first time about anti-Semitism around the world and what had happened, not just the Holocaust, but even before that, and really got into the idea of having a Jewish homeland, and that felt very important to me. After the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, my Zionist friends justified that for me. You know, Israelis may have been killing little Palestinian kids, but that's because they were throwing bombs, so what's the choice? And so I lived with that. And it was really maybe in 1984, 85, I was at the Vancouver Folk Festival, and a friend of mine was managing the dance brigade at that time. And she really encouraged me to come see a piece they were doing on Sabra and Shatila. And I was very uneasy about it, but I did, and I sat down with her, and I watched that piece, and I started sobbing. And I realized that I didn't know at that point how to bring together the fact that I felt very proud to be a Jew and what Judaism stood for in the world, and the fact that something was going on by the Israeli government that was breaking my heart and that was very against the things I was fighting for in Central America, in South Africa, as a lesbian, etc.
Rosenwasser recently returned from a trip to Israel and the occupied territories, where she interviewed both Palestinian and Israeli women.
To me, there's no justification for the treatment I saw of Palestinians. I can't have my freedom built on the back of somebody else. That's not freedom, you know? That's precarious. That's not the kind of life I want to live. I think there's another choice, and it may mean we have to compromise. Hey, you know, that's life. But there's a way that I can be happy, and that I think Jews can find some level of peace and serenity and it not be at the expense of another people.
Rosenwasser explains that she had to unlearn some of her own stereotypes about Jewish people, even the positive ones.
I certainly had this image, oh, we're for social justice, and if nothing else, the experience of this government of Israel teaches me we're no chosen people. We're no better than anyone. We're as wonderful as everyone, and we have all the problems and all the weaknesses and all the fallacies, and that's good for me to know.
On Wings, this is Susan Revo's 1990 documentary, titled Not in Our Names.
Naomi Seidman is a graduate student studying Jewish literature in Yiddish, Hebrew, English, and German. After living in Israel for several years, she realized her concerns were not only for Jews, but for Palestinians as well.
What happens to me politically is an obsession with Israel, with dealing with the problems, and this is sort of new for me to think about the Palestinians too, and it's just a commitment to think about both peoples and all peoples.
Seidman explains that her political changes did not come easily.
I just want to make clear what the emotional freight was that Israel always had for me. I mean, it was never separate from the murder of my father's 8 brothers and sisters. It was never separate from his experiences in the Warsaw Ghetto. For a minute, it was his story. It was a story of a survivor. And he always invested it with not only his own history, but the history of 6 million murdered Jews. I still feel the strength of his argument, but I guess I'm beginning to listen to other people's stories too. I'm recognizing that my father's story isn't the only story in the world, and I'm beginning to hear Palestinian stories and stories of non-Zionist Jews, and recognizing that history is something which has a million stories.
Seidman draws upon the philosophies of Hannah Arendt and Judah Magnus, early Zionists who foresaw the imminent destruction of European Jewry. They advocated a binational homeland for Arabs and Jews, but opposed the establishment of a Jewish state.
For me, it's kind of encouraging to find out that Judaism isn't a monolithic idea, but that as progressives in this particular cause, we can look at a specific history which was never acted on, maybe, but which is still there. The kinds of things that Judah Magnus and Hannah Arendt were formulating in the late 30s and early 40s about forming a binational state. There was always another strain of Judaism, and we don't need to create ourselves from scratch, but to reactivate strands of Jewish thought and Jewish history which have been suppressed. And it's encouraging to feel that our place is as Jewish as anyone else's, even though it hasn't been part of the dominant mainstream.
Bracha Seri is an Israeli Jew who was born in Yemen. Her political activity began at the other end of the spectrum, in the religious settler movement. Believing that settlement was the way to peace, Seri tried to increase the representation of Sephardic Jews among the settlers, who were mainly Western Jews. Not until she began teaching Hebrew to Arabs did she learn that the settler ideology encouraged oppressing and killing Palestinians.
And so I understood that in order to make peace, we have, first of all, maybe to understand, listening to the so-called enemy, because we can't just solve the things among ourselves and just deny the existence of the other. And so I started talking to Arabs more and more, and I got information that I never knew it through newspapers and radio.
She feels that the Holocaust is unfairly used to justify policies toward Palestinians.
They're fighting for survival like we are in biblical time or in the Holocaust. And then hate Arabs because of the Holocaust. It's not fair. Israel sends arms to Germany and brings the Holocaust all the time to encourage the war against the Arabs. And it's not true historically, because Jews in the Middle East, in Arab countries, have lived there, and they didn't suffer as much as in Christian or European countries, not to mention the Holocaust.
The Spirit of God is so proud. Let the healing between Sarah and Hagar be the peace between Isaac and Ishmael.
I grew up as an American Jew who lived in a home where We were all very strong supporters of the policies of Israel and never would question Israel. It wasn't until 1984, when I became a delegate for Jesse Jackson at the National Democratic Convention, that I met the first Palestinians that I ever knew and who have, until this day, remained very close friends of mine. Even after meeting them, I remained silent on the issue of Israel and the Palestinians. I was president of the Board of Education in Berkeley, and when I decided not to run for re-election, it was right around the beginning of the Intifada. And I would watch CNN, and I would see these young soldiers, these Jewish boys, beating people, shooting people, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I mean, it just really shocked me. I grew up believing that Jewish people don't do this, that Jewish people don't beat their wives, they don't drink, that we have this higher moral ground. And I was shocked.
That's Barbara Lubin, executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Active on progressive issues for many years, especially in causes around children, Lubin was devastated by what she saw on the television news. In 1988, she organized a delegation of elected officials on a fact-finding mission to the occupied territories.
We were just totally blown away by what we saw. I mean, we witnessed beatings, shootings. We were caught in the middle of a gun battle. We were stopped by Israeli soldiers and body searched and abused, and we were tear gassed. We were in a home just talking to some Palestinians, and Israeli helicopters flew overhead and shot tear gas into the home. And when we would try and get out of the house, they would shoot more tear gas at us. So we witnessed firsthand what was going on there for Palestinians.
As a longtime disability activist and a mother of four, including a Down syndrome child, Lubin has been active on issues of education and children's rights.
So I felt like I wanted to do something for the kids, that I was just couldn't believe what was happening and what the lives were like for the children of Palestine. So we started the Middle East Children's Alliance in May of 88, and we have literally been working around the clock since that time. And in the last 2 years, we've taken 45 people over on delegations, and we've sent over about $100,000 or taken over about $100,000 for projects that we're supporting. Medical clinics, pediatric clinics in Kalandia Refugee Camp and Jabalia Refugee Camp, preschools.
Lubin believes American Jews have a special responsibility to speak out.
Those of us who are Jewish and have come out on this issue and are standing up and speaking out have got to find ways to approach the other people in the Jewish community in this country and move them over and make them understand what's happening. And if they don't care about what's happening to Palestinians, then they must care about what's happening to Israelis. Since the beginning of the Intifada, approximately 50 young Israeli soldiers have committed suicide. The incidence of wife beating has risen very high. The effects on Israeli society are profound. And if you love Israel, if they love Israel, then they will work to see that there's a resolve to this whole issue.
Lubin recently returned from a delegation that met with a number of Israeli and Arab officials, including Shimon Peres, head of the Labor Party. She describes her impression of the meeting.
I thought that he was racist. Somebody asked him about the school closures, and he sort of poo-pooed it, and it wasn't important, and, you know, after all, they're where they're organizing, and somebody said, well, how much organizing could be done in a kindergarten? And he just sort of laughed it off. And then he talked about in Israel itself as a democracy, and Arabs and Jews are living together, and things are terrific. I just finally couldn't stand it any longer, and I just said, Mr. Peres, I said, I can't believe that you're talking about education so offhandedly. I said, for us as Jews, education means everything. I said, and you talk about it as if it's of no importance. I said, how come it's so important to us? I said, you know, I'm listening to you and you're breaking my heart. This is frightening. I said, have you ever been to the town of Lod? I said, there's a situation where Arabs and Jews are living together, except Jews live with electricity and indoor plumbing. And in Lod, in the Arab section of Lod, the Arabs, the Palestinians, are living with shit running down the street, with no electricity. I said, I met a little girl whose entire right side of her face had been eaten away by rat bites. We saw enormous rats running through this section of Lod. I said, what do you say to this? You know, he had said that there are equal services in all of these areas. I said, how can you lie like this? And he said, oh, they're Bedouin, and went on to the next question.
Lubin feels that some of the recent political stands taken by mainstream Jewish organizations, along with the policies of the Israeli government, are isolating Jews from the world community.
Recently, the Jewish community in the United States just keeps shooting itself in the foot. Jesse Jackson in New York, this whole Mandela thing has just been astounding. It just absolutely astounds me that we, or not we, some Jewish groups could attack Nelson Mandela. Why? Because he recognizes that the struggle of Palestinians is almost identical to the struggle of black South Africans because he embraced Yasser Arafat? Well, it's just very sad.
Lubin believes that Israel's security depends on its recognition of Palestinian human and national rights.
Finding a place for Jews to live and to be secure and safe is a good idea. Can you be safe and secure at the expense of another people? I don't think so. I don't think there's ever going to be any real security for Jews in Israel until there's been a negotiated settlement with Palestinians. On the other hand, there are security issues for Israel. I mean, I think it has to be acknowledged that Iraq is not something to, you know, just pretend isn't there. There have been a lot of moves from Iraq and statements being made that are very frightening. And there are people out there that believe that Israel shouldn't exist. But I think that the reality is also that Israel has the fourth mightiest army in the world. They have over 200 nuclear bombs. I think they're in a pretty secure position. I think it's less a question of security for Israel than a loss of moral standing. And I think that Israel needs to save its soul, not its soil. Israel needs to look at itself. I mean, certainly their role in all over the map was just outrageous. In South Africa, in Central America, in Ethiopia. I mean, Israel can no longer talk about the moral high ground when they're sending cluster bombs and over 200 military advisors to Ethiopia killing children. Cluster bombs are outlawed in every international forum. And here we're killing children with cluster bombs. And to me, it's not clear whether it's the United States policy or it's Israel, but I believe that Israel is really a pawn of the United States and that it's the expansionist policies of the United States that Israel's just carrying out.
Lubin says that people must understand that they can criticize these policies out of concern for Israel.
The most important thing people can understand is that you can care about Israel and what happens to the Jews there and criticize it. You know, when I was in jail and fighting against the Vietnam War, and I spent a lot of time, I was a draft counselor, and I was in and out of jail all the time in the 60s demonstrating. I felt I was very American by doing that. It was because of caring about America that I did that. And I remember people would say we were anti-American and the attacks that we came under. But, you know, we all stood up against that, and we made it very clear that we loved America, and that is why we were doing what we were doing.
An alternative voice exists and is growing within the Jewish community. Many Jewish women are feeling a particular responsibility to speak out against the policies carried out in our name. Special thanks to Jenny Schwartz and Chewy Varela. This program was co-produced and engineered by Barry Korngold. I'm Susan Revo. Thank you for listening.
Not in Our Names was produced by Susan Revo in 1990. It first aired in Wings in 1991. The Middle East Children's Alliance is still active in 2024. Wings thanks your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Our memories as a community are the heart of our legacy, helping us create a journey down the lanes of time. Do you have photos, videos, or audio recordings of West Cannes performances, rehearsals, or events? We want them all. We are building a special archive to showcase the beautiful moments we've shared together. Dust off those old photo albums, dig into your video archives, and share your West Cannes memories with us. Simply contact 514-641-9149. Let us relive the joy, laughter, and the cultural richness that has defined West Cannes for almost 50 years.
This is Funk Doc.
And this mess stinking.
When we ain't chilling up in the bricks in the Shaolin, we chilling out here in Montreal.
On CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
Today on Wings.
Matriarchal societies. Studies on indigenous cultures across the globe.
What is most important, I think, is that they don't have an economy of accumulation.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Heide Gettner-Abendroth, a German feminist, is a pioneering scholar in matriarchal studies. She received her doctorate in philosophy from the University of Munich. Her research is focused on culture and society, especially matriarchal societies. Among her many writings are The Dancing Goddess, Principles of a Matriarchal Aesthetic, and The Goddess and Her Heroes, which looks at the historical evidence for Indo-European matriarchal religions. In 1986, she founded the International Academy Hagia in Germany for matriarchal studies and matriarchal spirituality. She founded and guided the first two World Congresses on Matriarchal Studies in 2003 and 2005, as well as a major conference on matriarchal studies and politics in 2011. In 2013, Gettner-Abendroth toured North America to discuss the findings of her latest book, Matriarchal Societies, Studies on Indigenous Cultures Across the Globe. This 533-page book presents the results of Gettner-Abendroth's pioneering career-long research into matriarchal societies existing among indigenous cultures in Asia, Africa, and the Americas. The research is based on a new definition of matriarchy, not as rule by mothers or women in general, but as gender egalitarian and economically balanced societies founded on maternal values such as nurturing and peacemaking. Matriarchal societies are typically organized around a clan structure. Matriarchies make political decisions by consensus and are characterized by nonviolence. Today, Wings presents an interview Dr. Gettner-Abendroth gave to Canadian documentary maker Kristen Schwartz.
Can you describe, please, the features that you would identify as key to matriarchal societies?
At first, I think it's a very interesting point that we can see matriarchal societies as not having violence against women and children. It's a very interesting point for us today in a world where violence is so much increasing, especially against women and children. But how do matriarchal society implement this? We cannot start from the wrong notion and idea of matriarchy as women's rule. This is the usual misinterpretation, which is completely wrong. I researched matriarchal societies for many years through all my life, And from existing matriarchal societies, I could learn that this is a gender egalitarian society. They practice equality between the genders and respect between the generations. And equality between genders is not a formal thing as we have it here in our democracies, but the equality is implemented because each gender has its own sphere of action, its own sphere of economy, of social action, and then these different, two different spheres in these societies are combined in a mutual beneficial way. What makes them matriarchal is that the mothers are at the centers, not as rulers, but as the facilitators who keep the society together. For example, when they make their decisions, they do it in a consensus way, discussing their decisions in the clan houses, in the villages, and on the regional level, all by a system of complex councils, until a region has reached unanimity for each decision, or a clan house, or a village. And when you have these consensus-based societies in politics, a class and domination of one gender by the other and hierarchy cannot develop. And so everybody has its place and has its possibility to do, express his or her opinions, has the opportunity to take part in the councils and to bring all this together in a balanced way. So violence is not necessary in such a society. It's not necessary. You are always active in all these affairs, be it in your clan house, or be it in your village, or be it in your region. You are an active part in all the things which are done there, politics, economics, and cultural things. What is most important, I think, is that they don't have an economy of accumulation. The economy is one that is based on leveling different levels of wealth, which can occur by good luck with a harvest or good luck with a trade. Then they have a wonderful principle to balance this wealth, for when they have their many annual festivals, those who are better off with their wealth are the one who invites the whole community, and they make the festival for everyone, and they give away the wealth in a gift-giving way. So they support each other in this way, so you don't have really poor people and you don't have really rich people, for this distribution and circulation of wealth as gifts among each other keeps them on an equal level, also economically. And so another reason for violence is not there. You have not the economic tensions between groups or between individuals, which very often occurs violence in our societies. So they have no need to be violent, especially not against women and children. Maybe that men sometimes quarrel with each other, but this is not very serious. But women are very much respected, and mothers are so much respected, and the mothers are the facilitator of these societies and keep all this net of balancing the things economically and politically. They keep it together. So when I say mothers are at the center, it doesn't mean that they rule. It means that they keep this horizontal society with equal distribution of wealth and consensus finding in politics together. What is very important in these societies, these are the critical criteria, the most important criteria. These are societies which are based on matrilineality. All titles and names are given in the mother's line. And that the mothers, or the women and the mothers, are the contributors of the food and of the basic things you need for life. And they are the contributors equally to all the clan members who are in this network with them. But the role of the mother is one that cares for everybody, cares for the society, and cares for keeping the balance. So the mothers are very much respected, and they are the ones who consciously keep up not only balance, but peace-building. And peace-building is a value which is followed by everybody in this society. And violence is the opposite of peace-building.
As we look at the kinds of societies that you have researched historically and in the current day, we can see that they're very locally oriented, generally based on local agriculture. Do you have thoughts about how to apply some of those lessons and values that you see in those societies in our world, which has become not local, where production is spread across continents, where the patriarchal institutions have accumulated wealth from vast regions and try to control these large regions? What do you take from what you've learned about past and existing societies and think about how to apply that?
At first, I would like to say that these characteristics which I gave are from still existing matriarchal societies, which we can find all over the world, in the continents Asia, Africa, and the Americas. You cannot find out their ways, how they do politics or how they balance their wealth. You can't find this out from past matriarchal societies. We have only relics and some myths of past matriarchal society, which gives us glimpses, but we cannot find out the whole functioning of such and such a society by archaeological or mythological remnants. It's not possible. Therefore, I focused with my research on still existing matriarchal society to find out the whole picture. And this whole picture is very fascinating and very interesting. When I'm describing it, sounds much better than the patriarchal society in which we are born. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that this is a paradise. These people also have problems and have to solve their problems, but they solve their problems in a different way. And they have different problems than patriarchal societies. They don't need violence, and they don't need to steal, and they don't need to murder to survive what is common in patriarchal societies. So I think this setting of social guidelines which they have is much better than patriarchal ones, even if people are humans like we are. You asked me what's the vision how to implement these matriarchal guidelines in our modern world. At first, I would like to say they still exist in our modern world. In the indigenous cultures, all in these many continents, in these diverse continents which I mentioned. Of course, they are under oppression from the patriarchal neighborhoods and centralized states, but they are still there. Otherwise, I could not have done this research and could not have found their very interesting ways of life. From the very beginning, I was thinking what we can learn from these very interesting societies, from the very beginning. Of course, we cannot go back to a traditional matriarch society, because we are not agriculturalists. We live in a highly technical world. So what can we learn? At first, I would say our world is over-technified and it's over-organized, and it's all our units, our social units, are too big. And the patriarchal market tends to make it bigger and bigger by globalization. And with globalization, they don't take care about humans, they don't take care about nature, they don't take care about communities, about culture, nothing. Only globalization, the market. Globalize the market and globalize the money. This is the tendency we have today. And I think this is not a good tendency. So we should not look how we can change these big units, for these big units are too big and will not survive. They are big like dinosaurs, which didn't survive. And I think we have to come down to human-sized institutions and human-sized communities. And when I think about this, the best way is to go back to the regional level. We need new, flourishing, prosperous regions for people know each other in region. A region can be bigger or can be smaller. It depends on cultural history and special boundaries of the landscape, what makes a region. And in a region, you can have a transparent policy, you can have good functioning neighborhoods, and you can have all the goods which are produced in a region will be enough for a region. We do not need to import our food from other continents of the world. If you are living in a region where people are creative and can do their agriculture and can do their technical work, then you can have all the things which we have in a region. We can even have a special kind of technology which we are accustomed to today. For the problem with technology today is not that we couldn't do it in a region. The problem is monopolizing it. They are all monopolized. But if these monopoles are dropped or are abandoned, then you can construct computers and internet and so on and so on. You can have it all on a regional level. So I think when we start to think in a region, you can have your nourishment from the region, which is much better for nature. You can produce your high tech in the region, which is much better than monopolizing it. And you have your social contacts in a region, and you can do a relatively transparent policy in a region. So I'm an advocate for regionalism and not for big nation states and big superpowers and big superpowers. We don't need them. They are not human-sized, and they don't serve the humans. People, they don't serve the people. They only serve big business and big markets. This is one lesson we can learn from it. And I think another lesson is how we can implement consensus politics. Consensus politics is a true basic democracy. It's much more democratic than our former democracies. Yes, you can implement it on the regional level. And giving women a better role than they have, overcoming patriarchal role models, is also possible in the region. For in a region, you know each other to some extent, and you can do your politics in consensus. You can give everybody adequate place, and the role of women will be much better than it is in these huge super nations.
Do you have any comments about the role of women in the progressive social movements underway throughout the world? They're always underway, and women have played incredible roles in many of the socialist revolutions. What do you feel women should be striving for when they're working within those movements?
If we look in our what's happening in our present days, then you can find some matriarchal elements, as I call it, in alternative movements. For example, a new attitude towards nature in ecological movements, or a new understanding of women's importance in the feminist movements, or a new understanding of how to go on without war at any corner of the world, in the peace movements, and so on. And we have very important and interesting movement is the communities movement, where people come together forming new communities, like new clans living together to get rid of this isolation, of the individualistic isolation in which so many people are. There are many elements which, from the matriarchal perspective, I would name them matriarchal elements. Even if it's not conscious to these people, because they don't know the structure and the full picture of a matriarchal society, they don't have this in mind, that we can have a completely different type of society, of way of life in which people can live. But I'm in contact with several of these alternative movements. I'm a feminist, and I'm in contact with many friends of the community movement, and I have good contacts with people of the indigenous movements. And some are aware when we have dialogue. Some get awareness about the matriarchal underlying values they are fostering, and I make them aware about this. For it's much better to see a vision of a whole society which is completely different to patriarch society. It's better than only to have a little part of it, a part here and a part there. So the role of women, I think this is a crucial point in many alternative movements. When I talk to people in community movements, I always ask, what's the role of women in your community? And I often learned that they have so many good ideas how to deal with money and deal with their land and deal with their community, but they have very little ideas how to change the roles, the traditional roles of men and women. And I think this is typical for a lot of alternative movements, even the socialist movements. In every of these alternative movements, women play an eminent role, but the place which is given to them does not correspond to this eminent work they do, very often. So I think a new matriarchal movement, which could include all these elements, should be initiated and led by women. The point is that most of these alternative movements have been created and led by men. And, of course, these are not the usual type of men, and they reflect a lot of what they are doing, but they don't go far enough. They stop at the crucial point about men's and women's roles. And I think also women have no deep ideas about their very important role. So there is much to be done there. And especially, we take the example of the socialist movement. It was supported by so many women, and so many interesting and strong women worked in it. And in the end, when they took over the power, what happened? Women were reduced to the traditional marginal role. We saw this in many examples. And this has to be changed. And this can change only if we take seriously the patterns of matriarch societies, where women are at the center and create society and create the balance and create all this networking for what is very important there for us, say, women and mothers at the center means that the people act according to maternal values and not to values of, yes, the alternative values are also very good, but they don't go far enough. When you have women at the center, especially mother at the center, and everybody follows maternal values, which are caretaking, nurturing, peace building, and caring for the needs instead of caring for status and wealth, these are maternal values. And in matriarch societies, they come from the mothers. The mother is a prototype for this attitude. They come from the mothers, and everybody in a matriarchal society follows these values. Mothers and the women who are not mothers, and women and men alike. So, that is much more important than if men are founding alternative movements. At some special step, they find themselves or define themselves at the center, and women are marginalized. And this must be changed. For when women are at the center, they never marginalize men, according to matriarchal values and principles, but they integrate men on a level of equality and a level of mutual respect. And this is a big difference when you compare it with the alternative movements, how they are going on today.
I just have one last question, and it concerns the statement that you made at the outset about the different roles or spheres for women and men. I'm wondering if you can say a bit more about that. There's a lot of talk in the sort of Western feminist tradition around avoiding biological determinism and being concerned about slotting people in particular roles according to gender. So if you could address that concern, and also you basically talked about maternal values as something that's not exclusive to biological mothers, right? But if you could expand on that, the concern that people might have about talking about different roles.
You see, what is very interesting in these maternal values are values which everybody follows. So, and it's not an essentialist system, not at all. For what is very interesting is they don't define what is a woman and what is a man according to the sex. This is our way to define women and men, and we have a lot of rebellion against this fixed roles. In matriarch society, they define what is a woman and a man according to the action sphere and the sphere of work. These societies have always two halves. The one half is the action sphere of women, the other the action sphere of men. And what is a woman or is a man, you can see from the action sphere, not simply from the sex. So you have the interesting situation in these societies that if a boy wants to live as a girl, then he is respected in his wish, he dresses like a girl, and when he's grown up, he's working in the women's sphere and is respected as a woman. And if you, vice versa, is a girl who wants to be a boy and later a man, she is working in the male action sphere, and so she is respected as a man. You see, this role, and there's no problem with them, it's very easy. There's never a problem, no problem. And they do not need fights against forced heterosexuality and forced role models. They don't need it because this is an individual choice. So what's not change are the action spheres, because this society is based on these dual action spheres, which is defined as male or female, but this also is not fixed. In some societies, it's just the action spheres are just the opposite of the other one. I give you an example. In the city of Juchitán in Mexico, which is organized matriarchally, women are the traders and even to far distant trades, and men do the agricultural work. So this is their action sphere, combined with rituals, combined with special things and so on. But this is not essentialist way, for in another society, for example, the Mozo in southwest China, where I did research, the men are the traders and do the far distant trade, and the women are the agriculturalists. You can have even matriarch societies which are close by and have a completely different set which is defined as male and as female. In a special society, this cannot be changed, otherwise this society would lose its balance. It's following a principle of balance. But the individual boy or girl can decide in which sphere she or he want to be. So they don't have these problems with essentialism and biological roles. Even if I say mothers are at the center, you must not be a biological mother to be respected as a woman or a mother, for they have the idea and the practice of common motherhood of sisters. So if in a clan house there are five sisters and one or two have three children, every one of these sisters is called mother of these children. This is a common motherhood. So you see, they don't deal with it in an essentialist way. It's more a symbolic way, for this common motherhood gives every woman the respected title to be mother, and every woman, because they do the work together, is free to choose her profession or her work as she wants. I think matriarchal women would find it horrible that in our society one woman alone should work, should have children, should care for a husband. It's horrible for them. They would never choose them. This is the true essentialism for them.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else that you'd really want to say? Is there any point that we haven't sort of addressed that's really important to you?
I would like to give much more of my knowledge to interested women and men if they want to learn from matriarch societies. For me, it was a lifelong learning from these societies. And for me personally, it was also recognizing more and more what patriarchal patterns all are. It's not only the institutions and the military and so on. It's much more the way how we feel, the way how we look and conceive the world. All is, we are so educated in such a deep patriarchal way, conditioned. We are conditioned in this way. So it was for me a very long learning process, not only about matriarchal societies, but also about all the internalized patriarchal patterns which we take as normal and as business as usual. Yeah? And I had the privileged situation that I could recognize this and try to get rid of this more and more and more. And I think for me it gave me new energy, and it was really a healing process. And I would like that many women and men who are raised in patriarchy and suffering from these patterns could learn and find a new consciousness and find a new energy by learning from matriarch societies.
You've been listening to Dr. Haida Gettner-Abendroth talking about the characteristics of matriarchal societies. Dr. Gettner-Abendroth is the author of Matriarchal Societies, Studies on Indigenous Cultures Around the Globe. It's published by Peter Lang International Academic Publishers. This recording was contributed by Kristen Schwartz, a community-based radio broadcaster in Toronto. Kristen interviewed Dr. Gettner-Abendroth for the radio documentary Women, the Oppressed Majority. Wings thanks Kristen Schwartz for use of the sound. I'm Kelia Ramirez-Watson in Berkeley, California.
Since this interview was recorded, Dr. Haida Gettner-Abendroth released a new book, Matriarchal Societies of the Past and the Rise of Patriarchy in West Asia and Europe. You can hear her discuss that project under special events on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of many works on the gift economy and host of the series of salons and special events at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org and visit our daily women's news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Le cash, ça change le monde.
En est,
j'ai une histoire à raconter.
Un million, qu'est-ce
écoute
que
ça.
Un million.
Le cash a fait de toi ce que tu voulais. Mais le voulais-tu vraiment? Tout a une fin et un jour tu le subiras. On dirait que c'est quand tout va mal que tu laisses tomber. Mes frères qui aujourd'hui ne le fait sans mais sans pitié. Avec une pute toujours en lutte après les stéréotypes. Quel est ton type qui connaisse toujours à la banque ton livre? Qu'est-ce que tu disais à propos de cash? Réplique faut que avec le H et toi
avec le crash dans l'arrache.
Ton lit est comme le cinéma, les murs. Pendant une espace, combien de temps as-tu perdu pour avoir eu un orgasme? J'réplique, j'ai de la misère à croire. Il me semble qu'il y a d'autres choses à faire à bord en noir. Mais d'être salope à temps partiel à se faire fourrer. Je sais que ça paraît pas pour toi, mais les preuves sont de mon côté. Qui a perdu ses amis? Qui est aujourd'hui seul? Il te reste le cash oublié, t'aimerais que je ferme ma gueule.
Je rêve de rêve comme toi depuis ma tendre enfance. Puis toi, tu me plaques là pour un gars de la France. Fuck that! T'as fini de me surprendre. Quand tout a débuté, tu te rappelles. T'étais en bas déjà prêt à aller au ciel.
Et je t'ai reconstruit à la hauteur d'un gratte-ciel.
Après, tu me lances en bas du 20ème. Ça, j'ai toujours pas compris, mais où est passée la flamme qui m'allumait, qui m'éclairait le chemin de la vie? C'est que j'entendais le nom quand soufflait le vent. Je sais que j'étais pas le plus brillant, mais j'ai toujours été un des plus compétents. Pourquoi avoir oublié aussi rapidement les bons moments passés à mes côtés? Comment tout ça a pu arrêter? Du jour au lendemain, tu présentes comme un gamin bleu petit gamin. Mon mental, virgule, journée trop matinale. Arrête de jouer la femme fatale.